After coursing throughout the blood vessels of our bodies, a hormone eventually meets a receptor that was created specifically for it by the target cells that it was sent to stimulate. And the way that hormone interacts with the receptor happens in one of two very characteristic ways, and I want to show you today how that happens. And so the first major mechanism of hormone action at the cell that I'm going to start with is by secondary messengers. And I'm going to start with secondary messengers because historically they're a little bit more confusing, but essentially what's happening is a hormone is binding to a receptor on a cell. So let me draw a cell and its receptor. And I'll draw a hormone binding to it. But the process of that binding, instead of just stimulating the effect, it really sets off this chain reaction that leads to secondary messengers inside the cell being released. So let me draw those. And you've got these secondary messengers being released, and these are actually what's stimulating whatever effect is desired, whether that may be insulin being released or glucose being taken up inside the cell or any of the other countless things taking place in our bodies that are controlled by hormones. And so in order to give you a visual for how this might take place in the cell, I've pre-drawn some pictures in a key. So let me pull those in here. And I want you to be sure that these drawings are not to scale in any way, but really this is the best I can at least do in explaining the process because all of this is happening at the atomic level and atoms are really tiny. But anyway, what we have in this picture is a receptor, and I've drawn that in pink, and it's located inside the cell membrane. So this is the phospholipid bilayer of the cell membrane, and we've got the inside of the cell and the outside. And then also in the cell membrane, we've got a G protein, and I've drawn that in green. And it's called a G protein because it binds to molecules that include the nucleotide guanine, and that's the same G from the DNA bases that you might be a little bit more familiar with. But it's currently bound to a molecule called guanine diphosphate, and then we'll see how that changes. But we also have this adenylate cyclase enzyme that's in the cell membrane, and remember that an enzyme speeds up reaction, so we're going to see how adenylate cyclase speeds up a reaction. But what starts this process off is the hormone is going to bind to the receptor, so it's going to look like that, and you're going to have the hormone bound to the receptor. And once that hormone binds to the receptor, it's going to change shape, and that's going to allow it to interact with the G protein here, and so that looks like this. And what you saw happen was that as the G protein interacts with the receptor in a hormone complex, it's going to exchange that GDP that it started with, that guanine diphosphate, for GTP. So essentially it's exchanging a guanine bound to 2-phosphates for a guanine bound to 3-phosphates. And what happens is that enables the G protein to move through the cell membrane and interact with adenylate cyclase. And so that activates the adenylate cyclase. And as an enzyme, the activated adenylate cyclase facilitates the conversion of ATP, which is the energy currency of the cell, into CAMP. And CAMP stands for cyclic adenosine monophosphate. So we've taken this ATP, or adenosine triphosphate, and created cyclic adenosine monophosphate, and we also have the additional 2-phosphates. But it's the CAMP molecule that activates the protein inside the cell whose effect is really being targeted by the hormone in the first place. And so eventually the system resets, but not before several adenylate cyclase enzymes were activated, resulting in a lot of CAMP being produced. And so we call this signal amplification. And what I mean by signal amplification is that in theory, one hormone can bind to a receptor, and that process can set off a chain reaction that leads to a lot of CAMP being produced. And so it can mean that less hormone is required to ultimately activate the protein or the effect that's being desired. And so secondary messengers are a means in which hormones act on the cell. But really, if I'm being honest, this effect happens differently for a lot of cells, and And all of the mechanisms of secondary messenger hormone action aren't known right now. And honestly, there are a lot of secondary messengers other than CAMP. But really the takeaway is that for the majority of the hormones in your body, binding to the cell surface activates a series of reactions that initiate a response inside the cell. And so it's very similar to the use of a phone service provider. And because we as people, let me draw us, because we're unable to communicate directly with people sometimes because of separation or convenience or lack of efficiency, we use a phone service to project our voice to them through a phone conversation. So through a phone conversation, we'll direct our voice to people that we want to communicate with, or maybe we use the delivery of a text message. A text message will transmit some intended message that we have for people that we can't communicate directly with for whatever reason. And so that's very similar to how secondary messengers assist hormones that can't communicate with a receptor directly inside of the cell. And so peptide hormones and catecholamines, both of which can't cross the cell membrane, use secondary messengers to communicate. And then the other major method of hormone action on a cell is as a primary messenger. Certain hormones like steroids and thyroid hormones can actually cross the cell membrane, and it eliminates this entire middleman system that we set up before. So let me pull in another cell membrane. And so the hormone crosses the cell membrane and it binds to a receptor that's located either in the cytosol or in the nucleus. And so we could imagine a nucleus, and there might be DNA inside. But when the hormone binds to the receptor that's either in the cytoplasm or inside the nucleus, that binding process is going to directly affect transcription in the nucleus or translation in the cytoplasm of the protein that's being activated by the hormone. And this process has quite a few less moving parts than the secondary messenger system did. But again, it kind of stems back to the fact that these are steroid and thyroid hormones that are typically lipid-based and are capable of crossing through the cell membrane on their own. And so they don't need all of that extra machinery set up for them. But anyway, these are both primary messengers and secondary messengers, and those are the two main processes by which hormones act on the cell that they're created to target. Have you ever thought about the way that different parts of our body communicate? You know, I think we often consider the body to be this one complete thing, this self, but really our body's composed of lots of parts. There are lots of organ systems, and each of those has organs, and all of those organs are made of tissues, and all of those tissues are made of cells. And it's crazy, but there are 100 trillion, or at least roughly 100 trillion cells in our body. So it's curious then, how do those 100 trillion different parts communicate? Well, one way is through the nervous system and through the prelate tracts of nerves, but not every part of the body is connected by nerves. I mean, how, for example, would part of the brain go about communicating with part of the kidney? Well, to talk about that, we're going to have to talk about the endocrine system. And the endocrine system is a system of organs that are called glands. And these glands secrete little chemical messages that are called hormones. And they release those little chemical messages called hormones into the bloodstream so that they can circulate from one part of the body to another part of the body in order to initiate an effect. And there are many parts of the body that use these hormones to communicate, but certain organs are really defined by this method of communication, and we call them endocrine glands. And so one of the major endocrine glands is the hypothalamus. And the hypothalamus is located right here. It's a member of the forebrain. And as a member of the brain, it receives a lot of those signals that we talked about from the nervous system. So those nerve signals are funneling into the brain, and the hypothalamus then, as a kind of dual member of the endocrine system, funnels those signals into the pituitary gland. And so because it plays that dual role between the endocrine system and the nervous system, it often gets taglined as the control center of the endocrine system. In addition to stimulating the pituitary gland, the hypothalamus actually makes some hormones itself also, and so it makes ADH and oxytocin. And ADH is antidiuretic hormone, and it's a main regulator of our fluid volume in our body. And then oxytocin is a hormone that stimulates the uterus to contract for females during pregnancy. And so that's the hypothalamus, member of the brain and member of the endocrine system, where it all begins, the control center. And then right below the hypothalamus is the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland is located right here, dangling right below. And so the hypothalamus is about the size of a grape. And the pituitary gland is actually about the size of a green pea. But this little green pea is so important that it's called the master gland. And it's called the master gland because the pituitary gland takes that stimulation from the hypothalamus and it directs it to all of the other endocrine glands, or at least almost all of the other endocrine glands, such that their function is ultimately dependent on the pituitary gland to work well. And so that little green pea is a really important part of the endocrine system. And so one of the endocrine glands that the pituitary directs is the thyroid gland. And the thyroid gland is located right here in your neck. It wraps around your trachea. And your trachea is your windpipe, and so you can feel this thyroid gland on your neck as you swallow. If you hold your hands right around your Adam's apple and swallow, that meaty thing moving up and down, that's your thyroid gland. And one of its main jobs is regulating your body's metabolism. And it does that through the thyroid hormones T3 and T4. And another name for T3 is triiodothyronine, and another name for T4 is thyroxine. But the thyroid uses these hormones, the thyroid hormones, to stimulate the body's metabolism, which is crucial because that's how our body gets energy. And then right behind the thyroid gland are four spots known collectively as the parathyroid. And the main role of the parathyroid is regulating our body's blood calcium level. And the level of calcium in our blood is hugely important because calcium does a lot of stuff in our bodies. It's involved in muscle contraction, it's involved in bone growth, and all of those functions are really sensitive to the level of calcium that's floating around in our blood. And so the parathyroid glands, those four spots on the back side of our thyroid, regulate calcium through the hormone parathyroid hormone, or PTH. And then moving down the torso, we have the adrenal glands. And the adrenal glands are located right on top of the kidneys here. And they're called the adrenal glands because they're adjacent to, or right next to, the kidney system, which is called the renal system in medical speak. But we really need to further divide the adrenal glands into two parts, the outer part and the inner part. So the outer part is the cortex, and the inner part is the medulla. And the reason for the distinction is that the inside and the outside of the adrenal glands have two different functions. And so we'll start with the outside, or the cortex, and that's where the steroids, the adrenal corticosteroids, are made. And two major examples of steroids made in the adrenal cortex are cortisol and aldosterone. And cortisol is one of the body's stress hormones, so it functions to increase blood sugar in times of stress so we have energy. And it also has some anti-inflammatory functioning. And then aldosterone is one of the major regulating hormones of our body's blood volume and how much fluid is in our veins and arteries. And so that's the cortex. And then the medulla makes a class of hormones called catecholamines. And two major examples of catecholamines are epinephrine and norepinephrine. And I'm going to shorten those as epi and norepi. And sometimes epinephrine is called adrenaline, and that might be a little bit more familiar to you, but these catecholamines are really involved in our body's fight or flight response, that adrenaline response that we have to a stressful or scary situation. And so the medulla and the cortex make up the adrenal glands, but moving down the list and down the body, we have the gonads. And in females, those are the ovaries. And in males, the testes. And the gonads release the sex hormones. And so in males, the testes produce testosterone, and in females, the ovaries produce estrogen and progesterone. But these sex hormones are mainly involved in the development of our secondary sex characteristics, like pubic hair and larger frames in males and breasts in women, but they're also involved in progressing us through those life stages that accompany those sex characteristics, like puberty and menopause. And then last but not least, we have the pancreas. And it's located right here in the upper part of the abdomen. And I saved the pancreas for last because it isn't involved as directly with the pituitary glands as the other endocrine hormones were, but it still uses those hormones to stimulate an effect in a different part of the body. And the effect that the pancreas stimulates is control over the blood sugar. And it does that through the hormones insulin and glucagon. And the pancreas is vitally important because without its hormones, insulin and glucagon, we can't regulate how much sugar is in the body's blood versus the cells, and that can lead to major diseases like diabetes. And so with the pancreas, we can conclude our list of major endocrine glands. And so as we look at these glands and at these hormones, and we think about all of the different effects that are being stimulated in our body by them, it becomes pretty clear that there aren't just a few of these circulating in our bloodstream. There are literally loads of hormones circulating through our vasculature at any given moment. And so that poses a potential problem. If, say, that you're in the brain and you're trying to tell something to the kidney, you're trying to send them a message, and you put that in the bloodstream and you just float it down to them, how do you know that it's going to get there? I mean, isn't that what every other endocrine gland is trying to do? Well, it turns out that hormones are a lot like radio waves. In your city or in your town, there are many different radio stations, and there are many different songs being played at any given time by those radio stations. And even maybe from the next town over, there are radio waves filling the air of your town. But unless you're tuned in specifically to that station, you're not going to pick up on the song that's being transmitted. And in a very similar way, a hormone is not going to be received unless there's a very specific receptor on the target cell. And so the receptor and its location are very important in determining the hormone function. And we have classes that we use to help us identify which hormones fall into which function. And so the first class are autocrine hormones. And autocrine hormones function at the cell that makes them. An example of this is the T cell in the immune system. It actually secretes a hormone that it makes called an interleukin that signals the cell itself to increase its effectiveness in its immune function. And then another class of hormones are paracrine hormones. And paracrine hormones function regionally. And an example of that might be the hormones released by the hypothalamus that direct the pituitary gland. And then last but not least, kind of the classic class of hormones are the endocrine hormones. And these are the hormones that function at a distance. And an example of this might be the pituitary gland stimulating the gonads way far away. And so we have autocrine, paracrine, and endocrine classes that help us determine how a hormone functions. And so I know I just told you a whole lot about hormones, but this is your introduction into one of the most important ways that the 100 trillion little tiny individual parts of your body communicate. All right, in previous videos, I introduced steroids to you as one example of the chemical messages that our body parts use to communicate with each other. And we call those chemical messages hormones, but I haven't really gotten to tell you all about steroids and where they come from and how they're made, and that's what I want to do today. And so to accomplish that, I really need to start by introducing you to terpenes. And terpene might not be the most familiar of words, but it refers to a class of lipid molecules that are made of a repeating distinct set of carbon atoms called isoprene. And so I'll draw on that carbon unit called isoprene. And isoprene has this really distinct structure of four carbons chained together. So 1, 2, 3, 4, with a fifth carbon branching off of one of the middle carbons. And this five carbon unit repeats to build larger and larger molecules. And so as two 5-carbon isoprenes come together, you get a molecule that has 10 carbons, and we call that a monoterpene. And one of my favorite monoterpenes right now is menthol, which looks like this. And this little guy is super helpful to me right now because I've had a pretty rough cough for the past week and my cough drops are filled with menthol. And then if you add one more isoprene, you'd have 15 carbons. And that would give you 3 units of isoprene. And we'd call it a sequiterpene. And one example of a sequiterpene is ginger, and ginger looks like this. But you can see that ginger is made up of 3 isoprene units, and it fills up ginger snap cookies, and those are my favorite types of cookies. And so really you can just keep adding these isoprene units and making larger and larger molecules. And so I'll just go ahead and make a chart here. And remember, monoterpenes had 2 isoprene units and sequiterpenes had 3 isoprene units. And if you added another isoprene unit to that, you'd have a diterpene. And it would have 4 isoprene units making 20 carbons. And it's called a diterpene now because it's really just 2 monoterpenes put together. And then you could add another one and that would give us 5. And 5 isoprenes for 25 carbons, and that would be a sesterterpene. And you could just keep going, and you could have 6 isoprene units for 30 total carbons, and that would be a triterpene because essentially now we've got 3 monoterpenes. And then if you added another monoterpene to that, you'd have a tetraterpene. And that would have 40 carbons and 8 isoprene units. But really, this could keep going, and we could keep adding isoprene units, and we'd find lots of nice plant oils that we'd make and vitamins, but that, unfortunately, is not our goal today. We're still talking about steroids, so I'm going to shift to how our body uses these isoprene building blocks to create the chemicals that it needs, and that's a process that's called biosynthesis. So let me clear some room so that we can talk about biosynthesis. And in biosynthesis, our body starts off with isoprene bound to something called pyrophosphate, which looks something like this. And I'm going to use the letter R to represent that isoprene unit for now, just so I can really show you what pyrophosphate looks like. And so that's pyrophosphate. This green area is pyrophosphate. And you probably won't be expected to know too much about pyrophosphate, But what you should know is that it's a really weak base, which makes it a good leaving group in organic chemistry. And that's the important part, because for the reaction that our body uses to build with these blocks of isoprene, it needs a good leaving group, and that's pyrophosphate. And our body really begins with two different isoprene pyrophosphates, and they're found in nearly all living organisms, and those are dimethyl allyl pyrophosphate and isopentyl pyrophosphate. And I've just shortened the pyrophosphate to OPP because that's what most textbooks abbreviate it as, and it saves quite a bit of time. But I will go ahead and write out the names of these just so I don't confuse you too badly. And those names make pretty good sense if you've practiced naming carbon molecules in, say, an organic chemistry class or something. But they probably sound like a foreign language if you haven't. So let's not get too hung up on them here, because they don't help us much with the concept anyway. But what happens is the electrons of one pi bond act like a nucleophile, and they attack this carbon, allowing the pyrophosphate to leave. And that results in a 10-carbon molecule called geranyl pyrophosphate. And so that's geranyl pyrophosphate. And then that process might happen again, leading to a 15-carbon farnesyl pyrophosphate. And forgive me if I'm butchering that pronunciation, but I'll draw it in. And that's farnesyl pyrophosphate. And then as these chemical reactions continue, our body eventually produces a triterpene, or if you remember, that's a 30-carbon molecule made of 6 isoprene units, and that triterpene is called squalene. So let me draw that in. Okay, just wanted to make sure that I actually got 30 carbon molecules in there, and I think I did, and that is squalene. It was important for me to get to squalene because this is the molecule that forms the base of all of the steroid hormones that our body makes. Now that the light's at the end of the tunnel a little bit, I'm going to move a little bit more quickly through these reactions. So let me just copy and paste here. I'm going to clear a little bit more space. And so the body takes squalene, and through a series of ring closing or cyclization reactions, it makes cholesterol. And we consume some cholesterol in our diet, but our body also completes this reaction in the liver. So our body takes squalene and turns it into cholesterol in the liver. And cholesterol travels through our blood, and it lives in the inside of cells and on their surfaces. And in the case of endocrine organs that use steroid hormones to communicate, cholesterol can actually be altered to form the very characteristic steroid backbone. So let me draw that. And so these are the 4 characteristic rings of the steroid backbone. And as you can see, we are a really long way off at this point from the very beginning place that we started, which was that isoprene unit. And so now that I've dragged you all the way from isoprene to the steroid backbone, I figured it was only fair that I showed you that this actually happens in your body and there are actual steroids floating around your blood. And so I mentioned before that there are two important classes of steroid hormones in the body, and those are the sex hormones and the adrenal cortex steroids. And so with the sex hormones, I mentioned before estrogens. And we have estradiol and estrone, and you can see their steroid backbone, and those are predominantly made in the ovaries, and they're principally involved in secondary sex characteristics for females. And we have progesterone. And it's kind of the pregnancy hormone. It's involved in prepping the uterus, and it's also involved in maintaining a healthy pregnancy. And then we have androgens. And we have testosterone and androsterone, and similarly to the estrogens, those regulate the secondary sex characteristics, but more so in males, and they're predominantly made in the testes. And then moving over to the adrenal cortex steroids, we had cortisone and cortisol, and those are the body's stress hormones, and so they have a lot of effects from anti-inflammatory to increasing carbohydrate metabolism. And then we also have aldosterone. And aldosterone is one of the main hormones that regulates our body's blood pressure and the fluid volume. And so I hope all these images make steroids a little bit more familiar to you now that you've seen the classic backbone and you know how to make it. And maybe the next time you find yourself enjoying the soothing relief of a menthol cough drop or a savory and delicious ginger snap cookie, you'll think about the countless number of terpenes that you're enjoying. When we talk about the endocrine organs and the endocrine glands, and we talk about hormones flowing all throughout the body, it's pretty easy to develop this mental image of that process happening pretty haphazardly. And so you kind of imagine hormones just coursing all throughout the body, being fired up well and sent everywhere. But if you think about the effects of the endocrine glands, like in the adrenal gland with the fight or flight hormones, it becomes pretty important that the effects being stimulated by these hormones be well controlled, because our body's pretty sensitive to those effects. And so it turns out that the hormone concentration in our blood at any given time is pretty tightly controlled, and one of the ways that it's controlled is through this idea of metabolism and excretion. And so for every hormone that reaches its receptor, thousands more are swept up and removed by the body. And one of the ways that they're removed is through the liver. And the liver will metabolize extra hormones and turn them into bile, which is ultimately excreted in the digestive system. And another organ is the kidney. And you have two of these, and they're filtering your blood all of the time, and they're removing waste products from the blood through urine. And then some hormones are actually just broken down in the blood, and then the products of that breakdown flow into the liver or the kidneys, and then sometimes you can even sweat these hormones out. But the idea here is that all of the time, for all of the hormones reaching the receptors, a lot are just swept up and removed from the body. And another way that concentrations of hormones in the body are controlled are through feedback loops. And the majority of feedback loops are what we consider to be negative feedback loops. And the idea behind negative feedback loops is that conditions resulting from the hormone action suppress further release of those hormones. And that can be a pretty confusing idea, so I'm gonna draw out an example. So we have the hypothalamus here. I'm gonna draw it in. And I'll write it down. And the hypothalamus releases a hormone, thyroid-releasing hormone, so TRH. And it releases it, and it goes down to the pituitary gland, which I'll draw in. and right here. And in response to TRH, the pituitary gland releases thyroid-stimulating hormone, or TSH. And TSH goes down to the thyroid glands, which would be about right here. And the thyroid gland releases its hormones, T3 or triiodothyronine, and thyroxine. And these thyroid hormones travel all throughout the body. In search of the receptors in order to, let's say, upregulate metabolism. That's one of the major jobs of the thyroid glands. And so here's where the idea becomes pretty cool, because some of the receptors are located on the pituitary gland and the hypothalamus. And as the thyroid hormones reach the pituitary and the hypothalamus, they signal the hypothalamus and pituitary gland to stop making their hormones. And the hypothalamus and pituitary gland see that we have enough thyroid hormones in the blood and that they don't need to make any anymore. And so this is a major way that the thyroid hormone levels in the body are controlled. And you might say, hey, that sounds a little bit redundant. I mean, if the hypothalamus can be turned off by the thyroid hormones and it's upstream from the pituitary gland, why does the pituitary gland even have to have these receptors? But the redundance is really just a reflection of how important feedback control is and how important the concentration of hormones in the body is. And so hopefully what we can see is that the hormone levels in the body aren't haphazard and aren't willy-nilly, and that concentration is important. Okay, so today what I want to talk about is endocrine control. And in order to talk about endocrine control, I need to talk about two major glands. First, the hypothalamus. I'm going to draw that in here. And then in this enlarged image right here, this is just a blown up view of the hypothalamus. And then the next major gland that we need is the pituitary gland. And the pituitary gland is the gland that dangles right below the hypothalamus. And you can see that the hypothalamus is a structure right here in the forebrain, and the pituitary dangles right beneath it. And as a member of the brain, the hypothalamus receives neural signals from the brain and from the peripheral nervous system, and it funnels those signals to the pituitary gland, which ultimately controls the other endocrine glands and our body's hormonal response to the environment. And there are two different parts to the pituitary gland. You have the anterior pituitary gland, and then you have the posterior pituitary gland. And the hypothalamus interacts with the anterior and posterior part in two different ways. And so it interacts with the anterior pituitary gland primarily through the hypophyseal portal system, which I've kind of drawn in here. And the hypophyseal portal system is a capillary system, so little blood vessels that flow between the hypothalamus and the pituitary gland, and the hypothalamus secretes hormones into this little system, and they go down and they signal the pituitary gland. And so that would be an example of a paracrine signal, or a really regionally acting signal. And so one example of the hypothalamus hormones that signal the pituitary gland is gonadotropin releasing hormone, or GnRH. And gonadotropin releasing hormone, it's going to go down to the anterior pituitary, and it's going to stimulate the release of follicle-stimulating hormone and luteinizing hormone, so FSH and LH. And these hormones are going to travel down to the gonads in the male, the testes, and the female, the ovaries, and they're going to stimulate the gonads to release their hormones. Another example of how the hypothalamus controls the pituitary gland, which ultimately controls the endocrine glands, is corticotrophin-releasing hormone. And corticotrophin-releasing hormone stimulates the anterior pituitary's release of adrenocorticotrophic hormone, ACTH. Adrenocorticotrophic hormone goes down to the adrenal glands and it stimulates the adrenal glands' release of its hormones. And so moving along, the hypothalamus also releases thyroid-releasing hormone, or TRH. And thyroid-releasing hormone goes down to the anterior pituitary, and it stimulates the anterior pituitary's release of thyroid-stimulating hormone, TSH. And thyroid-stimulating hormone goes down, and it stimulates the thyroid gland to release its hormones, thyroxine and triiodothyronine. And so, continuing in that list, you have growth hormone-releasing hormone. And growth hormone-releasing hormone is the hypothalamus's signal to the pituitary gland to release its hormone, growth hormone. And growth hormone goes to the long bones and the big muscles in our body, and it stimulates growth. And then last but not least, we have prolactin inhibitory factor, PIF. And prolactin inhibitory factor is a little bit different because it's constantly being released, and when it stops being released, that's when the pituitary gland is signaled to release prolactin. And prolactin is a hormone involved in milk production in moms. And so some of the anterior pituitary hormones go down and directly stimulate other endocrine glands like FSH and LH, but some of the anterior pituitary glands directly affect parts of the body like growth hormone and prolactin. And so there's a nice mnemonic, flat peg, which helps me remember which one's which, because FSH, LH, ACTH, and TSH, or the flat hormones, are called tropic hormones. Let me get a different color for this. And the tropic hormones are hormones that stimulate other endocrine glands. PEG hormones are the direct hormones, and they include prolactin and growth hormone, and the E is for endorphins, which I haven't included in this list because the anterior pituitary does release endorphins, but so do a lot of other parts of the body. And so E is for endorphins, but the PEG hormones are direct hormones. And direct hormones stimulate a part of the body directly. So growth hormone directly stimulates the bones and the muscles, and prolactin directly stimulates lactation. And so the hypothalamus signals the anterior pituitary's release of its hormones through the hypophyseal portal system, or this little capillary bed. And then the hypothalamus also communicates with the posterior pituitary, and it does that through stimulation of nerves which run down that pituitary stalk right here. And the hypothalamus sends a signal down those nerves to the posterior pituitary and causes the posterior pituitary to release a couple hormones too. And I want to make a point because the posterior pituitary releases these hormones, but they're actually made in the hypothalamus and stored in the posterior pituitary. And the two major hormones are ADH and oxytocin. And ADH is antidiuretic hormone, and it stimulates the collecting ducts in the kidneys to retain water, and oxytocin is a hormone involved in uterine contractions in women. And so you see that a lot of the endocrine control in the body ultimately comes back to the pituitary gland, which is then controlled by the hypothalamus, which forms the bridge between the nervous system and the endocrine system. And so as big as the names of the hormones get, the idea behind them is pretty manageable. It's really just one part of the body stimulating another part of the body through chemical messages. Okay, so when I introduced the endocrine system, I mentioned that hormones can be classified by where they function. And we talked about autocrine function and paracrine function and endocrine function. But maybe even more importantly, hormones can also be classified by structure. And I say more importantly because the structure of a hormone really determines how it works. And so that's what I want to talk about today, the three major types of hormones. And the first major type of hormones are proteins and polypeptides. And just as a refresher, proteins and polypeptides are made up of amino acids, and these amino acids are linked together with peptide bonds. And so many peptide bonds come together to form a polypeptide or a protein. And these proteins and polypeptides form most of our body's hormones. And these hormones can range from small to large. And to give you an example of what I mean by that, imagine three or so amino acids linked together forming a hormone. That would be a small polypeptide. And three amino acids, we're talking about a handful of atoms, maybe 20 or so atoms. And just as a frame of reference, a cell in your body, one cell, has on the order of a trillion atoms just inside that one cell. And there are 100 trillion cells in your body. And so we're talking about very, very, very small things. And they can range from these small collections of amino acids all the way up to hundreds and hundreds of amino acids. So they can get quite large. And the break point becomes right around 100. And that's where we shift from calling them polypeptides to proteins. And just like all proteins in your body that are going to be excreted, proteins and polypeptide hormones are made in the rough endoplasmic reticulum of the cell. And I'll shorten that to RER. And they go from the rough endoplasmic reticulum to the Golgi apparatus. And from the Golgi apparatus, they're kind of repackaged into vesicles that can eventually be excreted from the cell. And because proteins and polypeptides are made of amino acids, they're typically charged, which makes them water soluble, but it also gives them a really hard time crossing cell membranes. And so typically their receptors are located in or on a cell surface. And because their receptors are located in or on a cell surface, and these protein and polypeptide hormones can't actually travel into the cell, what they do is they initiate a cascade effect of secondary messengers inside the cell. And I'm going to do an entire video about how that signaling cascade using secondary messengers actually works. But the main idea is that when these protein and polypeptide hormones bind to the cell surface, they initiate a response inside the cell. And we refer to that as a secondary messenger system. And so to save some time, I went ahead and drew in an example of a polypeptide hormone. And I'm going to kind of fade it in for us. And I want to show you on this drawing where the peptide bonds are, because these peptide bonds really pull this class together and unify them. And so right in between the carbon and the nitrogen here, and the carbon and the nitrogen here, I'll draw some arrows. These are the peptide bonds that I was referring to, these carbon-nitrogen bonds. And so they can be small and they can be large, but these links of amino acids that are used as chemical messengers to signal effects in the body are called proteins and polypeptides. And one example is insulin. Insulin is a relatively large hormone, and so it's a protein hormone. Okay, so we've got proteins and polypeptides, and then the second major type of hormones are steroids. And when we hear steroids, I don't know, the first thought that comes to my mind are a bunch of athletes getting in trouble with their regulating committees. But steroids are actually one of the major types of hormones used in our body to communicate. And so there are a lot of steroids in our body. But steroids come from lipids. And the major lipid that these steroids come from is cholesterol. And because they come from cholesterol, steroids have a really characteristic structure that all of them share. And so I went ahead and I pre-drew that as well. I'm going to fade that in. And so this is kind of the characteristic steroid backbone. And so you can see there are four ring structures here. And these rings are made of carbon atoms. And so there are three cyclohexane rings, or six-membered carbon rings, and one cyclopentane ring. I'm going to label those A, B, C, and D. And with this characteristic structure comes a really characteristic way of signaling a cell. And so unlike proteins and polypeptides, whose receptors are on the cell surface, steroids, because they're made of lipids, have a really easy time passing through the cell membrane, and their receptors are located inside the cell. And so steroids usually go all the way inside of the cell to signal their receptor as primary messengers. They're actually doing the signaling. And oftentimes their receptors are located either in the cytoplasm or all the way in the nucleus. But steroids typically go in and their effect goes all the way down to the transcription and translation level of proteins. And so as primary messengers, they're going inside the cell and they're affecting a change in that cell that's going to result in the transcription and the translation of new proteins and new products inside the cell. And I'm going to do a video on how these steroids actually affect the cell as well. But for now, I want you to be thinking of steroids as one of the major hormones that are in our body, not just a means for athletes getting getting an edge on the competition. And so some examples of big steroids in the body are those that come from the adrenal cortex, like cortisol and aldosterone. And those hormones that come from the gonads, like the sex hormones, testosterone and estrogen and progesterone. And so we've got steroids and we've got proteins and polypeptides, and the third major type of hormones by structure are tyrosine derivatives. And tyrosine derivatives come from the amino acid tyrosine. And you might have caught on that I said these come from tyrosine, which is an amino acid. And I told you earlier that protein and polypeptide hormones are made of amino acids. And so you might ask yourself, why do these get their own major class if these are also made of an amino acid? And what makes them really special, A, is that they're made of one amino acid, so one amino acid, tyrosine, is manipulated to make these hormones. And B, these hormones that are derived from tyrosine end up being able to sometimes act like proteins and polypeptides and sometimes act like steroids, so they really get their own class. And an example of tyrosine derivatives in the body are those that come from the thyroid gland, like T3 and T4, or triiodothyronine and thyroxine, that stimulate metabolism. And these tyrosine derivatives act really similarly to steroids. And then another example of tyrosine derivatives are catecholamines. And catecholamines are those hormones that are produced in the adrenal medulla that are involved in our fight or flight responses, like epinephrine and norepinephrine. And these tyrosine derivatives act really similarly to peptides by binding on the outside of the cell and releasing those secondary messengers inside the cell. And so the thyroid hormones that are tyrosine derivatives act like steroids, and the catecholamine tyrosine derivatives act like proteins and polypeptides. But it's important to remember that they form their own unique class because they're all derived from the amino acid tyrosine. And because I did it for proteins and polypeptides and steroids, I went ahead and I drew in what tyrosine looks like. So that's tyrosine. And that's the amino acid that this class of hormones is derived from. And so I know it's hard to make learning these types of hormones fun, but maybe at least we can let our minds blow up a little bit over the fact that the structure of these hormones dictates almost everything we think or do, from fear to hunger to urinating and pushing babies out. All of our responses to the world around us are signaled by hormones.